Welcome back to another episode of Cattle HQ, brought to you by South Dakota State University Extension. I am Olivia Amundson, based out of the Sioux Falls Regional Office, here with my colleague Kiernan Brandt, located out of the Watertown Regional Office. Today we'll be talking to Dr. Brian Vandelay on congestive heart failure in feedlot cattle. Brian, would you mind giving us a brief introduction?
Yeah, so my name is Brian Vandelay. I work out at the USDA Meat Animal Research Center, but I'm actually a UNL, University of Nebraska Lincoln employee. And to keep the centers apart, I work at the Great Plains Veterinary Educational Center that's on that campus. So out there, I do some quite a bit of research, but I also do some veterinary student teaching and graduate student education. And I also work for the University of Nebraska Extension.
So you got a lot of different hats, sounds like. Yeah, Kiernan and I actually, we had a conversation a few days prior, got to talking about how both him and I have had some experience down at the Meat Animal Research Center. I spent a little bit of time down there doing an internship with Jeremy Miles, and then did my graduate work with Dr. Cushman and Dr. Harvey Freetley. But then I also worked at the Great Plains at the Education Center. I worked with Dr. Dale Grotolution and then Kathy Whitman. So I've had a little bit of experience down there, as well as Kiernan.
Yeah, I think we got to talking about just some of the good old days at the Meat Animal Research Center. And I just think it's super, super funny how the further we get into this realm and this industry, the smaller the world really gets. Olivia and I have quite a bit of history in that regard. I ended up citing her a bunch in like my graduate research just to have her become a coworker on the other side of the country a few months later. And find out that we both spent time at the Meat Animal Research Center, which at the time I had no idea what really that beast was and how widespread the impacts that come out of that place were. I was just a kid that didn't come from an ag background that was trying to get some more experience during the summers while I was going to undergrad in Laramie. And it was during one of the last hiring freezes, actually. And so I ended up having to be a UNL summer employee rather than do any formal work through USDA or anything like that. But I think even at that point, I had an appreciation for some of the stuff that was going on, but really did not have quite the full picture of how much stuff is going on at Mark and how cutting edge a lot of that research is going on. And I thought it'd be cool, Brian, if you just wanted to talk for a second about what's going on down there right now. What are you guys working on at the Great Plains Vet Lab, and what's Mark interested in right now, and what are all the big wigs down there working on?
Well, let me start with Mark. I can't give you a very detailed overview. There's a lot of research that happens at US Mark. I think it holds the distinction of being the largest live animal based research institution in the world. There's about 8,000 mother cows that live at US Mark. There's about 1,000 sows, and there's about 2,000 to 3,000 sheep out there at any one time. So they're doing research on all those species. There's a tremendous amount of emphasis put on genetic research out at the U.S. Meat Animal Research Center. They're highly capable and very well equipped to do genetic work, state-of-the-art sequencing and many other facilities that allow them to do that stuff. They also do a lot of nutrition and reproductive physiology and meats, including food safety research out at U.S. Mark. So a great variety of things going on. The group that I work most closely with and what we're going to talk about today a little bit is the genetics of animal health research unit does work looking at mostly cattle, but also some sheep diseases. And we are interested particularly in some infectious diseases, a lot of things going on with coronavirus and bovine viral diarrhea virus. There's some immunology work that's ongoing, as well as some work with Manheimia and a couple of the other bacteria that are implicated for respiratory disease. But my principal collaborator over at the U.S. Meat Animal Research Center is Dr. Mike Heaton. And he and I together have really spearheaded the project to look at this congestive heart failure problem in feedlot cattle.
No, I was, when I was looking through your background, and one of the many hats you wear is veterinary epidemiologist. And I thought that was interesting that I guess I just didn't put those things together right off the bat, that an epidemiologist would be climbing into the genetic zestpool, if you will, that can often turn into when you start chasing these rabbit holes and things like that. Can you just give us some backstory on how you got involved in looking at congestive heart failure in some of these feedlot animals?
The first thing I should probably say is that epidemiology is basically the discipline that people who can't make up their minds get into. Epidemiology has I tell my students all the time, epidemiology is the science of associations. So we don't have to pick a realm too tightly and stick to it. We can move around a lot. And the reason I'm involved in this particular work is because we're looking at a number of associations, and the most interesting and the most research that we have right now in terms of results is in the association with heart failure and genetics. But we are also very interested in the associations between management and environment in this particular disease, because we're pretty sure there's some of that going on too. We just don't have a lot of evidence for it yet. We're kind of in that anecdotal or early descriptive evidence stage when we start describing some of those management environmental factors. But yeah, try to put an epidemiologist in a corner with regard to, you know, we're given a lot of latitude to look for things that are associated with each other. So it's a good discipline for me to be part of.
Yeah. And so you talk a lot about congestive heart failure in cattle, and this traditionally or has historically been associated with a higher altitude sort of situation. Mm-hmm. But tell us a little bit about what you're learning about congestive heart failure, because you mentioned genetics a lot.
Yeah. So one of the things that Dr. Mike Heaton at US Mark, when I first got involved in this research, pointed out to me is he said, there's certain diseases that give you really strong indicators that they're genetic. One of the indicators that we have observed very frequently with the disease that we're interested in here, which is heart failure in feedlot cattle, is that we'll have the same groups of cattle from the same source year after year have problems right next to groups of cattle from other sources that don't. So the problem is very much clustered within sources. We tend to see these clusters of cases that come from, you know, pretty unique and consistent genetic pools. I'm not going to say genetic lines because we don't really worry about that too much, but so the same sources of cattle from the same operations will consistently produce high numbers of these cases. And we tend to see them year after year produce a bunch of cases and in the same environment, the same feedlot with roughly the same nutrition, things like that. There'll be other groups of cattle that have almost no problems, which is a pretty strong indicator that there's some sort of unique factor about the place those animals are coming from that makes them more susceptible or more likely to get this disease. And genetics is one of the strongest factors when you start seeing a lot of diversity of sources. You know, we were seeing sources that had a lot of cases that were coming from all over kind of the High Plains region in some of these feedlots that we were getting reports of a lot of heart failure cases in. And that even more strongly implicates genetics as a factor. The other thing that's pretty strong implication is in this case, we tend to see it, and we do have the evidence to support this. It does seem to be in British cattle, especially Angus, when almost all the cattle. So it's, as an epidemiologist, it's really difficult. It's a little complicated to say what I'm about ready to say, but it's not fair to say that all the heart failure cases show up in black cattle, so it's an Angus problem, without actually showing that it's an Angus problem genetically, because almost all the cattle that get fed in the High Plains, or a huge percentage of them, are actually Angus cattle. So we can mistakenly draw some lines between breeds, with especially the Angus breed, because it's so common, But in this case, we've actually done the work to show that it really is, it's most significantly associated with the Angus breed.
I think a lot of guys in this part of the world obviously have those type of genetics already prevalently utilized in their operations. So, but I did think that was super, super interesting that, that you guys were seeing it almost, well, not exclusively by any means, but definitely predominantly in those black hided cattle. And I guess just before we get any further down talking into the specifics of what the impacts of this disease can look like and the effects that it can have and how we can kind of manage it a little bit better. Can you give us a little bit more insight into what exactly is going on in the heart when these problems manifest? Because there's some different things that can cause the heart to fail, right? But this is pretty specific.
Yeah, this is actually kind of, it's almost a diagnosis of exclusion at this point, because we see a lot of different ways that heart failure can occur. So there's three big buckets you can put heart failures into. One bucket is the medical term is diastolic dysfunction. So that's basically the inability of the heart to adequately fill when it's relaxed, because the heart doesn't fill through vacuum. It fills through the inherent pressure that's in the blood vessels. So that pressure causes blood to flow into the heart when it relaxes. So it's a very passive filling. And when anything puts pressure on the outside of the heart, it's really difficult for that heart to completely fill and then eject a full, like the largest volume of blood per stroke possible. So as the heart loses its ability to fill appropriately, it actually starts to decrease in its cardiac output goes down. And that will actually cause a backup of blood in the body that will manifest as heart failure. And we'll see that in cases like hardware disease, where an animal gets an infection that produces a lot of fluid around the heart. That fluid will actually start creating some pressure around the heart that prevents it from filling. And we'll see the very same signs that we see with high elevation heart failure or any other kind of heart failure show up, and it's because of the hardware. We can also see problems with the power stroke, the systolic function of the heart when it doesn't adequately pump. When that muscle is compromised, we'll see that a lot of times with things like toxins. The most common that we see is ionophores like rumensin or monensin and losalicin. And what those things do is they basically damage the muscle so that it can't generate as much force when it goes to contract blood or expel blood from the heart. So the third kind is what we see at altitude, which is basically a resistance to outflow. So when an animal, especially cattle, when they get up in high elevations, we usually think above 5,000, some people use above 7,000 feet of elevation. The shortage of oxygen actually causes little arteries in the lungs to constrict. And that's in normal circumstances, and that's usually really protective for the animal, because if a little bit of the lung gets diseased, they want to actually shut down blood flow to the diseased area because it's not getting any oxygen anyway. So they maintain a rich supply of oxygen by actually shutting down blood flow to places where it can't get any. What happens at altitude is it basically does that throughout the whole lung field. And when that happens, it puts tremendous back pressure on the heart. And over time, that actually makes the heart fail. So those are the three basic kinds of heart failure. We see all kinds of causes. So lymphoma is somewhat rare in cattle, but it happens with some frequency, and that will cause heart failure if it forms a mass around the heart. We'll see sometimes chronic pneumonias will get a version very similar to that seen at high elevation. But in our case, what we see is, well, first of all, it's none of those things. Like we ruled all those things out. So it's none of those. And what's unique about the type of heart failure we see is it looks a lot like what we see at high elevation, but instead of just affecting the right ventricle, which is the case with high elevation disease, we see it affecting both the right and left ventricle. So it's a different presentation of disease. And we also don't see it just at high elevation. We see this disease show up in cattle at 4,000 feet. We've got cases at 1,600 feet. We've even got a few cases that are quite a bit lower than that. So it's a little bit different. It's really important when we did our research to do necropsies to make sure it's not one of the other things.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. And that's kind of why I wanted to get you into that and give us a little bit more idea of what these guys could be looking for on affected animals that they might not be able to identify. Because some people I talk to in this part of the world have had experiences with it and kind of recognize what it looks like. Others have not seen it. And I think that could potentially become a problem if they start to have an outbreak or something like that and have no experience dealing with it. I think that could put some guys in a corner. So in the early stages, I mean, obviously I did my undergrad in Laramie, so I was used to interacting a little bit with Tim Holt coming up and doing some pap scoring on those yaks and yak crosses. They were doing a lot of that research at the time. Mm-hmm. Is that where you guys started with this, trying to look at maybe some pap measurements, some arterial pressure and like the heritability aspect there of trying to get it out of these cattle?
So I think the best answer to that question, that predates my time at GPVAC a little bit, but the best answer to that question is probably that our approach was different. And the way our approach was different is that, so one of the things that Dr. Heaton has given me a little bit of education on is that there's a couple of different kind of geneticists out there. I didn't know that when I started working at US Mark, but now I do. So quantitative geneticists are the folks that are very much interested in getting a lot of SNPs and associate. They're also scientists of association. They associate different regions of the genome with outcomes. And those outcomes that, you know, we're all very familiar with that it can be weight, you know, things like yearling weight, weaning weight, marbling, all those types of parameters. And PAP is one that they've tried to do that with. Dr. Heaton I think he refers to himself as a molecular geneticist. And the principal difference is that he's very much interested in finding mutations that have biological outcomes. So the process of figuring out where those mutations is somewhat different, but it starts from the perspective that we're not going to worry about pedigrees and heritability and a lot of those kind of typical genomic approaches to genetics. But instead, we're going to look for differences between animals that are very closely related, both in genetics and management and environment. And we're going to look in the genetic code of those animals and find differences. And if we match them closely enough, we assume that those are likely differences contributing to the difference in outcome. In this case, it would be whether or not they got heart failure or not. And in fact, that approach for diseases actually works quite well because we assume that most diseases are a loss of function of some kind in the genetic code. When we are looking for the genetics of disease, rather than doing broad associations, looking for biological functions can be a pretty powerful approach. Both can have value. But in this case, it's quite a bit easier when you think about, at least for me, I'll put this in terms of my understanding, but it's quite a bit easier for me to think about breeding away from a mutation than it is to think about breeding away from or breeding toward an EPD target or something like that. It's a little bit more amorphous. And so this, you know, good examples of that would be, you know, some of the common mutations that we see in livestock. For instance, horns is pulled is sort of a loss of function for the growth of horns. That might not be how geneticists think about it, but that's kind of how I'm thinking about it here. But it's pretty easy to breed away, you know, it's a binomial outcome, right? Or a yes or no. We either have horns on an animal or we don't. And it's relatively easy to breed away from horns if we want to, as opposed to trying to breed shorter and shorter horns until they disappear, right? It's a little bit different that's a little bit about how I think about quantitative genetics. So in this case, what we're trying to do is figure out how to turn the switches on and off, not have less and less. Now, to some extent, we're still going to see less and less of it occur. Like, we're not going to get rid of all of it, because we're starting to find out that, again, there's lots of ways that they might have genetic heart failure. Yeah, my law for 1 second there. But to answer a very specific question you just asked, we did not use PAP. And part of the reason we didn't use PAP is because you can see changes in the pulmonary arterial pressure associated with any one of those forms of heart failure. Hardware disease will increase PAP. Histophilosis in cardiac muscle will increase PAP. And also, all of those diseases over time will result in decreased PAP. It's kind of like fever, right? We see the same thing in feedlot calves. If we measure rectal temperatures in feedlot calves, when they start to get sick, their temperature goes up. And after a while, their temperature comes back down. And it does it for one of two reasons. One is because they've recovered, or two is because they're approaching ambient temperature, right? They're not with us anymore. So you can get a lot of interesting associations that are not real by using an outcome that has a lot of different paths coming into it. So that is, I think PAP, especially at high elevation, is a really valuable tool. I hear a lot of people talking about the value at elevation and how much good it's done for them. We were concerned in our study about the number of ways that a feedlot animal could get heart failure, and that it would PAP might not be a specific enough definition of disease to give us really clean genetic outcomes.
That was a really, really good way to put that. And I appreciate you putting that spin on it. And so you guys ended up looking at a huge data set of feedlot calves to then go ahead and end up pulling some out of that and making some pairwise comparisons then, like with affected animals versus genetically similar non-affected animals, right?
Yeah. So what we did is we had four cooperating feedlots that screened their cattle for cases of heart failure. When they found a case of heart failure, they would call us. We would travel out to the yard. We would euthanize that animal and do a fairly complete necropsy to make sure it actually did die from heart failure and not one of the versions of heart failure that we're aware of. And then we would select an animal from that case's home pen that had been basically raised the same way, usually from the same source. We assume from the same source. Sometimes, you know, the feedlot pen riders got really good at this. They would, if there was sire identification on tags, which in some of the custom fed cattle at these yards that we went to, that did happen, they would match it on sire at times. So at the end, I don't remember the exact numbers, but basically we screened about 150,000 head of feedlot cattle for cases. Out of that population, over about 2 years of time, we had approximately 125 cases that we went out and necropsied and collected. We actually threw a number of those out because they didn't meet our case definition. And our case definition was they had to be basically terminal congestive heart failure cases, meaning if we didn't euthanize them, they were going to die shortly. And they also couldn't have any signs of the other causes of heart failure. So if they had severe chronic pneumonia, we did not take them as a case. If we couldn't get an adequate control for them, we didn't take them as a case. So we did call the cases down, but we ended up with 102 pairs of cases and controls that were very closely matched, but actually from fairly diverse sources. Four yards contributed cases, those 102 cases. And within those 102 cases, they were actually from, you guys probably have the numbers in front of you, but it was like 30 some different sources, 36, I believe. I should have the numbers in front of me too. You guys are making me look bad.
I think the final count was 21, those 21 genetic risk factors.
Yeah. So when we did the analysis, we found 21 risk factors that met two criteria. One is they had to be in play in at least 25% of the case control pairs. And the second factor was they had to have an odds ratio of 3, meaning that the odds of disease in the animal with the risk factor was at least 3 times higher than the odds of disease in the animal that did not have it. So that's relatively, those are fairly stringent criteria. We think it's a pretty high bar, but some of the work, we're actually culling that list, and that's some of the research that's going to be forthcoming here in the next couple of months. There'll be a paper coming out. We actually came up with an even more stringent way to look at those numbers and further reduce the list. So the final list we have will have significantly less than 21 on it. And you notice in the fact sheet that's available, this is available on the US Mark website under there's a little menu option down on the toward the bottom of the homepage where it says BCHF or bovine congestive heart failure. We actually really worked on 2 risk factors that we found. So these 2 risk factors, we call them BCHF2 and BCHF5. They're actually associated with 2 genes. One of them is in it's called a control region. It's a non-coding RNA region for the people out there who have some genetic background. But basically, it's not the part of the DNA code that actually makes a protein or codes for a protein, but it's part of the code that controls how much of that protein or how often that protein gets made. So the one of the risk factors is in there, and it's a gene called NF1A. And it is there's a lot of functions that we could talk about, but very generally it's kind of involved in the determination of whether stem cells turn into muscle cells or white or brown fat cells is some of the research that we've been able to find. The gene is called ARDC3. We call this one BCHF5. It is associated with beta agonist receptor control function. And that the risk factor is actually in a gene and would actually code for a change from a tyrosine to a cysteine, which would actually probably change how the protein works. So that is very likely. We don't know for sure at this point, but it's very likely to be one of those biological, it is a mutation that has a biological outcome. So we're pretty excited about both of those. The 2 of them together increase the odds of disease 15 times over calves that have neither of those 2. So they're both pretty big risk factors.
Yeah, I was looking at some of that in your proceedings paper as well as in the fact sheet, and that's a significant number. And maybe I'm getting a little bit too ahead of myself, but since you guys have been able to isolate some of these risk factors, what can a commercial cow-calf producer maybe do to decrease the incidence of some of this congestive heart failure? You know, thinking down line a little bit here.
Yeah. So that's a challenging question to answer at this point for a couple of reasons. One is there's 2 numbers that we think are really important to measuring how well these 2 risk factors communicate the actual individual risk of a calf. And those 2 numbers are called positive predictive value and negative predictive value. So the positive predictive value is if we find both risk factors in a calf, what is the probability that that calf actually becomes a case? And that number is very low. It's less than 10%. So what that means is that animals can have genetic risk, but there's something else that has to happen to them. And that something is, we don't know what that is yet. So we suspect that will be genetic, environment, could be weather. You know, we've got a lot of ideas floating around, but we don't have evidence for any of them. We're working on that. The other number is negative predictive value. So negative predictive value is if they have neither risk factor, what's the probability or the risk that they will not become a case so that they will stay healthy? I'll say that one more time because that gets a little confusing. So negative predictive value is if they have neither risk factor, how likely they are to stay healthy. That's a little more straightforward way to put it. That is really high. It's over 95%. For our tests, or these 2 tests. So if an animal tests negative for both risk factors, more than 95% of them will never become cases. So it's actually probably closer to 98. It's a really high number.
That wraps up the conversation for today. Catch the rest of this conversation on the next episode of Cattle HQ. To get access to any references talked about today, go to the SDSU Extension website, and under Cattle HQ, there will be episode content and show notes. Thanks for tuning in today, and don't miss the conclusion of this conversation in our next episode. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll catch you next time.